Our God is the Lord of history. We are historical beings who both remember the past and anticipate the future. We stand on the shoulders and the faith of generations before us. They go back even before our faith was in written word. They pass down through the hands and hearts and minds and commitments of countless generations before us, famous and not even well known or remembered. Down through our parents, our teachers, our pastors, without whom none of us would be here today. Today we remember and celebrate one institution that has been one of the bearers of that faith, Westminster Wesley Theological Seminary. This fall, we begin its 103rd year of service. It was a little over 102 years ago, with a gift of 5 acres of land from Western Maryland College, with $2,500 of borrowed funds to build the first building, with $1,200 for the president's salary and housing, with a collection of college teachers and local pastors as its faculty, with 15 students, only one of which was enrolled in the degree program, the seminary began. Quote Doug Chandler's book, in the first catalog, the first president, Thomas Hamilton Lewis, touted the advantages of the location of the new seminary. You see, we're still talking about locations. It was only 30 miles from Baltimore with good train service. That's going down the tubes. The county seat town of Westminster is high and healthy, rural and prosperous, and providentially free from the immoralities of the city. Today, Wesley's combined student body, faculty, and staff number nearly 500. Our location in a power-possessed capital where many decisions affecting the destiny of all humankind are made. And yet, Thomas Hamilton Lewis's early response to some of the seminary's critics, I think, is an appropriate word for us today. When the question of founding a school for training young men for the ministry in the Methodist Protestant tradition was being earnestly debated in the Maryland Conference in 1882, to quote Chandler again, the challenge was forcefully put by the opposition. What are you going to found this institution on? Where is your experience? Where is your money? Where is anything for a foundation? And the answer that strengthened the hearts of his friends was, we will found it on faith. Today we share that faith. We share that common calling to prepare ourselves for that common ministry of carrying the gospel throughout the world for the sake of that world. We come today to remember and celebrate that history as a foundation on which we build our future. Come, let us celebrate and remember as we worship God.
I ought to claim a special privilege of standing here for a few minutes and just looking at you. You're such beautiful people, and I was sitting back there and couldn't see you until now. I cannot begin to tell you of the emotions and the excitements of standing in this spot on this occasion and reflecting on the years. This Heritage Day of ours is set squarely within the Methodist bicentennial year. In a way, that's unfortunate, because some of us may be so fed up with Lovely Lane, the Christmas conference, circuit riders and the like that, looking back, may be now a bit ho-hum. Yet our yesterdays still have claim to our heartstrings, and we recall them not so much dutifully as lovingly, because when discovered, the past nourishes our spirits, clarifies the present, explains the why of now, and points us to tomorrow's way. I'm looking back with tomorrow in mind. There is, of course, a sour view of history. Herbert J. Muller said that the French poet Valéry called history the most dangerous product ever concocted by the chemistry of the brain. Dr. Going, please take notice. History causes dreams, Valéry wrote. It makes nations drunk. It saddles them with false memories. It exaggerates their reflexes. It keeps their old sores running. It torments them when they are at rest. And it induces in them megalomania and the mania of persecution. It makes them bitter, arrogant, unbearable, and full of vanity. You see in what danger you sit. Now, there is some truth in this extravagant language. Read Barbara Tuchman on the nations and their ways. The Guns of August, for example. What a dreadful record of whipped up fury, hate, jealousy, and envy. As nations and their rulers looked into their histories and found excuses for their stupid wars. Has any nation, Christian or not, ever remembered what Jesus said about forgiveness? Jesus talked about heritage. He said, "You've heard it has been said, but I say unto you." And he infuriated his hearers by pointing out their silly claims to superiority and their phony traditions. God's chosen people? Ha! Don't forget that leper, Naaman, that widow, not one of yours, and that good Samaritan. You aren't all that perfect and preferred, he was saying. Nor are we. So all historians, the skeptical and the gullible, warn us that the past, no matter how ignoble or brave or foul or fair, or mean or kind, is still our mentor, our teacher, giving us equipment for the present and the hope that out of what we have become, we shall create what we ought to be. By what means and by whose labors then have we come to this heritage day? The first sentence of the first chapter of our centennial history states that for more than half of its first century, this theological seminary enjoyed the distinction of being the only seminary of the Methodist Protestant Church. I think you are old enough now to be told about the Methodist Protestants. I had not heard of them until I came to Maryland, back in the 20s that was, with my Kentucky bride, to a country circuit of four churches, and was told by the district superintendent that I could continue my seminary training at a small school only a few miles away. He said it was a Methodist Protestant seminary, but that it was a good school. Notice the pejorative "but" in there. And his degree would qualify me for membership and ordination in the Baltimore Conference. So I then learned about the Methodist Protestants, and I shall pass on some of what I learned to you. When the American colonies had achieved their independence and were creating a new nation, it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from John Wesley that all the Methodists in the New World should be joined in a new church, separate from their mother church of England and disjoined from the Methodists of Great Britain. And all the preachers gathered to do this at Lovely Lane Church in Baltimore in a Christmas conference of 1784. All the preachers. It seems not to have occurred to anyone to invite any layman to be present. And this is passing strange, for there was much talk in those days in America of such matters as representative government, voting rights, the consent of the governed, rotation and short terms in office, and the whole idea of government by the people, of the people, and for the people. This bypassing of the laity in the structure of American Episcopal Methodism was entirely consistent with Wesley's and Asbury's views on these matters. In his Observations on Liberty in 1776, Wesley attacked what he said was the supposition that the people are the origin of power, or that all government is the creature of the people. Wesley said that this was utterly indefensible, even though Mr. John Locke himself should attempt to defend it, because, he added, if the right of choosing his governors belongs to every partaker of human nature, then it belongs not to men only, but to women also, and to those under 21, and to those who have lived 80 years. Therefore, this boasted principle, he said, falls to the ground, and common sense brings us back to the grand truth. There is no power but of God. Government is a trust, but not from the people. It is a delegation, namely from God, for rulers are God's ministers or delegates. Such views seem incredibly archaic, even for 1784, but they prevailed in early American Methodism under Asbury, who wanted a church exactly as the venerable Father John Wesley wanted. But laicism and democracy were working in this country, and soon there appeared those groups of reformers or radicals demanding lay representation in all church conferences, the election of their presiding elders, as district superintendents were then called. The reformers also wanted local preachers' rights, the abolition of the episcopacy, the right of appeal of appointments, and safeguards on trials and appeals of ministers and members. Their motto was mutual rights and liberal Methodism. A church without a bishop in a country without a king. Free grace and free speech. One is your master, even Christ, and all ye our brethren. Those were stormy years. All Methodist conferences were turned into battlegrounds, sometimes shambles, where the old authority resisted the sometimes raucous demands of the protesters. Eventually, some reformers were expelled for sowing dissension. Others withdrew. The storm center was Baltimore. Then the reformers bought an Episcopal Church building, St. John's, and there in 1830 they called a convention and organized the Methodist Protestant Church, a church recognizing the mutual rights of ministers and laity, and a church without a bishop in a country without a king. One point of our heritage recall today is to be reminded that we are inherently and probably perpetually protesters. There is a pretty clear record on both of our campuses, Westminster and here, of our warfare against a multitude of the world's evils. I am tempted to wish you had come here sooner. You missed some beautiful fights. I recall with joy our fellowship with Quakers and the Brethren, or Dunkards, in Westminster. It was a precious hour when the FBI asked us about a conscientious objector who traced his stand to a faculty influence. And we enjoyed the consternation and dismay when blacks joined us in the first interracial fellowship the county had ever heard of. And the sweet pleasure of adding blacks to the seminary singers and seeing disbelief in the faces of rural congregations. We enjoyed their discomfort. I think we were a little bit like Billy. A little bit like Billy Sunday, who was accused of rubbing the cat's fur the wrong way, and he said, "Let the cat turn around." And with the passing years from this campus, we marched how many times on the Mall with thousands before the Lincoln Memorial singing, "We Shall Overcome." And we protested, I remember, by lobbying on Capitol Hill, by picketing the White House. We prayed in Lafayette Park and stood in vigil at the Pentagon and picketed the Russian embassy. And then there was a glorious morning when students and Vice President Wynne went by chartered plane to march at Selma. Protestants, protesters. Some of our protests didn't accomplish as much as we had hoped they would. The Pentagon outweighed us and outnumbered us. And the White House kept talking about the national interest. We learned sadly the grim truth attending all protests against prejudice, war, and poverty. A grim truth put forth by Admiral Zumwalt in his comments on the Catholic bishop's position on the nuclear freeze and the American economy. He said, "The bishops seek to appeal to the good in man. They fail to see that what works most efficiently is that which flows from greed." Now, this looking back has its dangerous aspects. Perhaps you are thinking of Lot's wife. But I have in mind those parts of the past we should discard, let go, scrap. We must remember and look back on the Holocaust. But we can and must destroy the hate that caused it. We shall not forget the sin of slavery and white supremacy, but we must forsake the greedy sins which fostered them. We may not forget Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but we must repudiate the sins of national pride and war which destroyed them. We must admit that protest has not created a utopia of love and grace, not yet. There will be much to protest in the days ahead. Our human ingenuity and amazing technology have brought us to the edge of unspeakable violence and to the rim of the abyss of extinction. And I'm trying to believe that God so loved this world that he gave his son to save it. And I know that's not an orthodox Christological view, perhaps. But I need to affirm it almost in desperation. And is there not an affirmation that is a part of every protest? While we linger over the heritage of protest, let us remember the need to affirm. And I'll leave you with Howard Thurman's affirmation to balance or complement our protestation. He said, "I affirm my faith in the little graces of life, the urgency of growth, the strength of laughter, the vitality of friendship. I affirm my confidence in the dignity of persons, their fortitude in despair, their strength in weakness, their love in hatred. I affirm my joy in the experience of living, the fragrance of nostalgia, the scattered moments of delight, the exhilaration of danger. I affirm my need of my fellows, the offerings of faith, the gifts of variety, the quality of difference. I affirm my hunger for God, the desire for fulfillment, the ache for understanding, and the sense of peace." God bless you all.